Sam Daly at Fort Buford in Dakota Territory. It's 11:30 on this 21st day of July 1881. Here at this United States Army post, 150 miles south of the Canadian border, Sitting Bull, the last of the great Sioux chiefs, has still not accepted a request that he ride in here to discuss peace terms with Major Fabid Brotherton, the commandant of this northernmost outpost on the Dakota Plain. Sitting Bull is still at his camp in the hill, 2 miles north of this fort, debating with his sub-chiefs whether he should resume his fight against the white man or ride into Fort Buford and surrender to the United States government. If Sitting Bull chooses to surrender, this tiny fort will witness an event which will go down in American history as a landmark in the 400 years of conflict between the white men.
July 21st, 1881, Fort Buford in the Dakotas. You are there.
The gateway to the Northwest waits anxiously for Sitting Bull, the chief of the mighty Sioux Nation, to decide whether he will fight or surrender. CBS takes you back almost 68 years to one of the most shameful moments in American history. All things are as they were then, except for one thing. When CBS is there,
you are there.
You Are There, produced and directed by Robert Louis Cheyenne, is based on authentic historical fact and quotation. And now,
July 21st, 1881, Fort Buford and John Daly.
Brought to us early this morning by an Army scout. Major Brotherton has known for 4 days that Sitting Bull, with a party of 200 brave squaws and children, had crossed the Canadian border into the United States. The commandant was informed of this by telegraph from the Canadian authorities. Since then, every Army officer, settler, and private in the entire Dakota Territory has been on the alert. No one has known what Sitting Bull's plans are. He's been out of the territory for 5 years, ever since his crushing victory over Custer's command at Little Bighorn. His return may be the signal for another Indian uprising, which will draw braves from all the reservations along the Missouri River here. When smoke signals were sighted yesterday, Major Brotherton immediately dispatched Captain Clifford and a party of 6 to meet Sitting Bull and to urge him to consider the United States government's terms for peace. Major Brotherton, the commandant of Fort Buford, is here now at our CBS microphone. Major, you sent Captain Clifford out to Sitting Bull's camp to try and stop the Sioux chieftain from leading another uprising. Is that right, sir?
Well, that's one way of putting it.
What makes you think that you can persuade a chief like Sitting Bull to give up his 20-year fight against the white man?
Well, I think that Sitting Bull has reached a point in his life where he's got to come in and listen to terms.
He never listened before, sir. He never listened to Colonel Custer.
Well, I'm not Colonel Custer. This time, Sitting Bull doesn't have 5,000 braves. He only has 200.
But, Major Brotherton, wasn't that the identical situation 5 years ago when Sitting Bull defeated Custer?
Well, maybe it was. Times have changed. Colonel Custer has been dead for 5 years. So are his methods of fighting the Indians.
What do you mean by that, sir?
Well, now we don't go after them the way Colonel Custer did. Now we close in on them gradually, and we force them to come into us. Just as we're forcing Sitting Bull to do. We're forcing him to come in and make peace.
But what if Sitting Bull's methods of fighting haven't changed, Major? Take those smoke signals he's been sending up.
Oh.
Isn't it possible that he's trying to call the braves off the reservations again and maneuver you into another Little Bighorn disaster?
No, that doesn't make sense. He can try it if he wants to, but he hasn't got a chance.
Why not?
Why, because Sitting Bull has lost his influence over his chiefs on the reservations. Low Dog, Crow King, Gull. They left him in Canada. Now they're living like white men.
Well, can you tell us what the peace terms are that you're prepared to offer Sitting Bull?
No, not now. If Sitting Bull comes in, why, you'll hear them.
Right. Thank you, Major Brotherton.
Sergeant, you come with me now.
Ken Roberts in a CBS mobile unit has reached Sitting Bull's camp 2 miles north of this fort, and so we take you now to Ken Roberts.
I'm standing outside Sitting Bull's lodge. It's a big tent-like structure made of a framework of sticks with buffalo skin thrown over it. These are the only quarters that were set up here since Sitting Bull's arrival last night. All around the lodge are the Red River wagons of the French-Canadian Indian trader, Jean-Louis Legal, who out of his own pocket has financed this expedition. Monsieur Legal is with me here at our microphone, and we'll speak to him in a moment. The squaws and the children are huddled in the red wagons of Lagar, and the braves of Sitting Bull are bunched together by themselves near the main campfire over there. It's easy to see that they are exhausted after their long ride from Canada. Most of them are wearing only one garment. Some are stark naked, grim evidence of the suffering and misery they have endured since leaving Canada. But whatever Sitting Bull decides to do, surrender or fight, his people are with him, as they always have been for the last 20 years. Don't you agree, Monsieur Lagar?
Oh, of course. These people love Sitting Bull. He is the mightiest personality of a dying people.
Monsieur Lagar, a short while ago, you were with Sitting Bull in his lodge. How is he feeling? What did he say?
He is in a dark mood. He is sullen. From the smoke signal coming from the reservation, he have just learned that the Great White Father in the White House, your President Garfield, was shot by an assassin 2 weeks ago.
Well, what has the attempted assassination of President Garfield got to do with Sitting Bull?
Sitting Bull have told me that President Garfield have promised to receive him in the White House and hear from his own lips the grievances of the Sioux people. Well, if your president should die, who knows what your next white chief will do? Sitting Bull trusts only the President Garfield. He said to me, we will not go to Fort Beaufort. We will not make the peace. We will cross the Missouri River at Wolf Point, cross the Yellowstone, go up the Tongue River into the mountain. There we will find plenty of game, hide from my enemy, till we get strong.
What did you say, Monsieur Lagar?
I'd say no. This is not right. This is war. No more war. No scalp. I say, come to Fort Beaufort, make peace. But Sitting Bull, he fight hard with himself, you know, inside. He want to do the best thing for the people.
And what do you think Sitting Bull will decide, Monsieur?
Oh, I cannot say. No one can know the mind of Sitting Bull. He's not like you and me. A simple thing like a compass or a watch or the telegraph, this he cannot understand. But there is one thing he can understand. And that is what makes him great. With the great men of all time.
And what is that, Monsieur Lagar?
He understand liberty. He understand that a man can endure anything but the loss of the freedom. 20 years ago, all these beautiful lands belonged to Sitting Bull and his people. No, it was their home. No, like yours, like mine. No, until the white man came. And little by little, they push him back. And when they cannot push him back, they make a treaty. No, they sign a piece of paper. Then they break their word. And they send soldiers to ram it down the red man's throat. Soldiers like Custer. That's a bad thing. That's a bad thing to think about. That's bad, bad, bad.
Thank you, Monsieur Jean-Louis Lagar, for giving us your feelings on this crisis. Here with me now is another man who has some thoughts on the matter. He is Captain Clifford, in charge of the United States Army Scouting Party. Captain Clifford, you've been listening to what Monsieur Lagar had to say. It seems to me that he made quite a case for Sitting Bull. Don't you agree?
No, I don't agree. I've known Sitting Bull for a long time, and he'll tell you that I've always kept my word to him. And I think you'll find other white men the same.
Then you mean there's no truth to his charge that treaties have been broken?
Oh, no. No, I didn't say that. I'm just saying that there are good people and there are bad people of all kinds. Just trying to set the record straight. This Canadian here seems to think that all of us are bad. That's not true.
Well, do you think that Major Brotherton is right when he thinks the Sioux Indians ought to live on reservations and adopt the ways of the white man?
Yes, I most emphatically do. The best thing for them. It's obviously a superior way because we wouldn't be here if we weren't. Well, now, for example, we'll teach them how to get and conserve their food under the ground by growing it, instead of on the ground by shooting buffalo. We'll teach them how to live in home, go to school, the ways of Christianity.
Well, suppose that Sitting Bull decides he doesn't want it that way.
It means that Sitting Bull and his people would have to go the way of the buffalo and vanish from the plains. They've got to live like white men now or die. There's no choice.
Well, Captain
Clifford.
One moment, please.
No, I must say this, Mr. Robert.
You say that you will make things better for the Indian, no?
That's what I said.
But Sitting Bull would say to the American government that is not the United States big enough for you? You have land enough for yourself?
Yes, but...
One moment, sir. Thank you. Sitting Bull would say, why not give back to the Sioux Nation the Dakota Territory?
Now, if you'll just listen
to me, Alex. Don't forget that you gave it to them by treaty, huh? And that is why your Custer was killed in 1876, when you tried to take it back by force.
Will you give me
a... It is ironic, is it not, monsieur, that your Custer was cut down as a tyrant in 1876, the 100th anniversary of your own war of independence. Fraternity, egalite, liberty, which you treasure so much.
I don't think that you're fair.
Only one more question, please, mon capitaine. For whom is your independence? Is it for the red man too, or for the white man only, huh? Thank you so much, gentlemen. I am finished.
You were going to say something, Captain Clifford?
Yes. I admit that mistakes have been made out here, but nobody, not even Sitting Bull and the whole Sioux Nation, can stop this country from pushing the frontier clean to the Pacific Ocean.
Thank you, Captain Clifford. All the time we've been talking, I've noticed one of the sub-chiefs of Sitting Bull looking at us from the campfire over there. He keeps fondling his knife and smiling at us. I don't know what that smile means, but I wouldn't like to guess what's going on in his mind. If Sitting Bull decides to fight, there are thousands of braves like this one on the reservations who will rally to a standard at the drop of the first tomahawk, just as they rallied 5 years ago against Custer. The smoke signals have been passing back and forth from this camp down the Missouri to the reservations. We have a correspondent at the main reservation at Standing Rock, about 100 miles down the Missouri. For a report on how the Indians there are reacting to Sitting Bull's return to Dakota Territory, I switch you now to Don Hollenbeck.
Here on this area are an estimated 10,000 Sioux Indians with their women and children. They represent the heart of what is left of the once powerful Sioux Nation. Right now, I'm outside the government post in the main village, standing by the lodge of Chief Gull. He's the former war chief under Sitting Bull. This lodge is in the center of a circle of shining white teepees along the banks of a small mountain stream. Chief Gull is sitting cross-legged at the entrance of his lodge, pounding on his war drum, and he's flanked by two federal armed guards. Chief Gull is considered to be the most magnificent specimen of his race. He's of medium height. He has a massive chest and shoulders, well-formed head, piercing eyes, and black hair, which he wears in braids. I'm told that Chief Gull has consented to pose for government artists. They plan to honor the Sioux Nation with a profile in the new 5-cent pieces. The chief's eyes are closed, and he's chanting a war song as he beats his war drum. And with me at our microphone is Major McLaughlin, the Indian agent of Standing Rock. Major McLaughlin, sir, why are those soldiers standing by Chief Gull?
Protective custody.
Well, does that mean, sir, that he's under arrest?
Protective custody.
Well, has this protective custody anything to do with Sitting Bull's return to Dakota Territory from Canada?
No comment.
Well, I've heard, sir, that you've put Chief Gull under protective custody because Gull was not only Sitting Bull's most trusted lieutenant, he was also the actual commander of the Sioux at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. Isn't Gull one of the few Indian commanders who knows how to handle a large force in the field?
That's a matter of opinion.
Well, will you tell us, Major, why he's pounding on that war drum and chanting?
That's an old Indian custom.
I see. Well, what's he saying?
Wouldn't interest you.
Isn't it true that he's sounding a call to arms for the younger braves here, urging them to ride north and join Sitting Bull at once?
Who told you that?
Your own soldiers.
Oh.
And isn't it also true that you haven't got enough troops to keep the braves on the reservation?
No comment.
Well, now it would seem to me, sir, that the Indians are doing pretty much what they did 5 years ago against Custer, only this time it's Major Bretherton at Fort Buford instead of Custer. Looks to me as if these people might make trouble. Are you intending to do something about it?
Major Bretherton at Fort Buford can answer that better than I can.
Well, thank you very much, Major McLaughlin, for your helpful interview. Do you mind if I try to catch the words of what the chief is chanting?
You may do so at your own risk.
Thank you, I will. I have a rough translation of what the chief is chanting. He's singing about Sitting Bull's great victory over Custer, whom the Sioux call Long Hair because of his blonde curls. The words go something like this. Long Hair, what are you looking for in our land? You were looking for death and you found it. And now you are lying in it. Long Hair, we had no guns, but you brought us some and we thank you. You charged us and gratified us. You made us thankful. And now let's listen to Chief Gall singing his war song.
This is John Daly at Fort Buford. We've interrupted Don Hollenbeck because we've just heard the news that Sitting Bull has reached a decision. Ken Roberts is calling in from Sitting Bull's camp with the details. Hello, Robert. Hello, Ken. What's the decision, Ken?
Sitting Bull has decided to ride into Fort Buford, John, but not to surrender. The agreement has been reached with Captain Clifford, whereby the Sioux chief will ride in under a truce. Sitting Bull wants to hear from Major Brotherton's own lips the terms the United States government is prepared to offer for the surrender of himself and his Indians. If the terms are honorable, and if Sitting Bull is satisfied that the United States government will keep its word, there is a strong possibility that the Indian chief will surrender for the sake of his people, but only for the sake of his people.
But, Ken, what if Major Brotherton fails to convince Sitting Bull of the government's good faith?
Well, if that happens, John, under the terms of the truce, Sitting Bull and his braves will be free to ride back to the open plains, and from there on, your guess is as good as mine. Right now, Sitting Bull is astride his chestnut horse, surrounded by his younger braves. His eight-year-old son, Crowfoot, is on a pony beside him. The women and children are all jammed in the red river wagons of Lagao. Only the last minute preparations remain now. Captain Clifford and his scouting party are mounted and ready to start. Or Sitting Bull has just ridden up in front of his braves. He's raised his arm, a signal to go forward, and the procession starts on its way to Fort Buford. How are the people at the fort taking the news of our coming, John?
Scout brought the news just a few moments ago, Ken, and of course it's caused a great deal of excitement around here, both among the soldiers and the settlers. Everybody is wondering just exactly what is going to happen. Almost everyone believes, however, that Sitting Bull will make peace and surrender, that the plight of his people gives him no choice. The bugle sounded a while ago to draw up the company of troops here at the post to receive the Indians, and they're getting into position now. The troops are armed, of course, and so are the settlers. Some of the women are out here with us, but most of them, mostly because they know what happened in the past and because they're a little uncertain of what's going to happen here and because of their youngsters, most of the women have gone into their houses with their children. Major Brotherton is inside his headquarters communicating Sitting Bull's decision to parley to the War Department in Washington. And as you probably know, Ken, he's been in contact with Washington ever since this business of negotiating with Sitting Bull started. If the Major can persuade the Sioux to give up their ponies, to lay down their guns, it will be a great personal triumph for him. Many before him have tried it and failed at the cost of millions of dollars, hundreds of lives. But we still can't see you coming in, Ken. You're somewhere behind that ridge still, I guess. How far out are you?
Well, we're just hitting the ridge now, John. Sitting Bull has stepped up the pace. We should be with you any minute now.
Well, that's fine. And don't let anything keep you away, boy. You know the Sioux language, and you've got to do the translating when Sitting Bull and Major Brotherton begin their parley. The chief doesn't speak a word of English, but I understand the Major does understand the Indian tongue.
Takisha, Onchni, O, Wahiksa.
What did you say, Ken?
I said, don't worry, John, I'll be there.
Oh, all right. This is a thrilling scene here at Fort Buford out in the Dakotas, the troops drawn up under a warm sun and a limitless sky. The settlers clustered in groups talking eagerly. Almost everyone here believes that Sitting Bull will make peace and live in friendship with the white man, and yet, soldier and settler alike, they want to be sure.
All eyes are focused on the ridge bordering the fort area. Yes, there they come, just over the ridge now. We can see you now, Ken. You're about, I'd say 100 yards away. Sitting Bull is flanked by his young son, Crowfoot, and Captain Clifford. Behind them, the brave, then the wagons with the squaws and the children. The settlers here are tense and expectant. Their hands grip their guns nervously. You know, last time they saw Sitting Bull was 18 years ago when he raided this very fort, burned down the sawmill, and carried away the saw, which he later used as a musical instrument in his war dance. Sitting Bull is riding into the fort now, coming up to the west wing of the headquarters building. The soldiers are pressing back the settlers to keep them well out of the way of any of the Indians. Major Brotherton's not risking any unexpected incident or clash, which might set off a catastrophe right here in the fort, the very moment when peace may finally be achieved. There's always been bad feeling between the settlers and the Indians, especially since Custer's massacre 5 years ago. Only one man survived that massacre, you'll remember, a Crow scout by the name of Scully. Sitting Bull has stopped now beside the building before the west wing of the headquarters building. So have the Indians behind him. The wagons with the squaws and the children are still coming up. And now Sitting Bull and his son have dismounted. The chief has turned to Captain Clifford. The captain points to Major Brotherton, says a few words to Sitting Bull, probably indicating that the commandant is the man he has come to speak with. Sitting Bull is walking towards us. He carries the Winchester rifle now, in addition to his revolver at his belt and the field glasses hanging around his neck. Major Brotherton waits in front of his soldiers, drawn up on foot in a semicircle behind him. Sitting Bull walks with a slight limp, but with a quick step and a distinguished bearing. Now he has paused before the major, one moccasin foot thrown slightly forward with the weight of his sinewy body resting solidly on the other foot. And now here's Ken Roberts. Take it, Ken.
Sitting Bull has not spoken. Major Brotherton is waiting. This is a great moment. Sitting Bull has always believed that he was divinely appointed to unite the Sioux into one great Dakota nation. Those who know him best say he is not a child nor a fool. He is not a warrior, but an Indian prophet. All he wants, they say, is peace and freedom. He is a friend of little children, women, and old people. He has always enforced justice. He is serious at all times, never jokes. He is magnanimous with his enemies and has never been known to kill a captive or to violate his oath. No doubt he is also wondering what kind of peace terms he may be able to wrangle out of the commandant. Those terms, you know, have not been revealed to anybody, but we'll be hearing them at any moment. And right now, that's Sitting Bull speaking now. Sitting Bull has just asked Major Brotherton to state the peace terms. He's come right to the point. He wants them right now from the commandant's own mouth. That's Major
Brotherton.
Major Brotherton has laid down the conditions of surrender. A full pardon for the Custer affair, food, clothing, shelter, if the Indians will give up their ponies and guns. Sitting Bull hasn't replied as yet. He is staring at Major Brotherton. These are unusually generous terms, considering the feeling out here over the Custer affair. Sitting Bull apparently thinks so, too, because he's just asked Major Brotherton if this is his sworn word of honor, and the commandant has answered yes. That's Sitting Bull again. Sitting Bull is still weighing the terms and the man. He says he's always had a reason for everything he has done. The Great Spirit gave him the land under his feet, and he never sold it or gave it to anybody. The Sitting Bull has come back to hunt buffalo as his fathers did, but most of all, he has come back to freedom, the right to move in the open country as he wishes. Now Sitting Bull has paused. He has put his arm around his son's shoulder. Sitting Bull says his people have suffered much.
Nie, we cho ie. Ya kaga. Wo okie. Wa achia.
Major Brotherton has given his word.
Mataka. Chokawaka. Chichu. Wana.
That is why Sitting Bull and his braves give up their ponies and guns now. This minute, Sitting Bull is surrendering. Here's John Daly.
Sitting Bull is surrendering. He's accepted the peace terms. He's handed his Winchester rifle to his son, and the boy in turn has handed it to Major Brotherton. Sitting Bull now hands over his revolver, gives it over to his son, and the boy once again turns and has given the revolver to Major Brotherton. On a signal from the Major to Captain Clifford, scout details have moved in among Sitting Bull's braves. They're taking the guns and the ponies from the Indians, and the braves, their eyes on Sitting Bull, giving them up without a word, without a murmur, although they're doing it with obvious reluctance. However, they'll take the orders of their great chief, and they are surrendering. Sitting Bull himself stands silently, watching, but a muscle of his face moves. His arm is still around his son. 20 long years on the warpath. Now here he is, yielding at last because of the hunger and the misery of his people. There's an air of sadness around Sitting Bull's majestic figure as he stands there. His eyes are fixed on the rolling plains, the green timberland running into the hills, the clear blue sky overhead.
Yes,
Major Brotherton has just said, Sergeant O'Donnell, arrest them, and the soldiers, the Hope Company, have suddenly leveled their guns at Sitting Bull and his braves. The Indians are completely surrounded. Sitting Bull has been arrested. All of his braves have been arrested with him.
Major Brotherton! Major Brotherton!
What's this all about, sir? Why are you arresting Sitting Bull? What are you going to do with him?
I'm going to put him in chains at Fort Randall. That's what I'm going to do with him. Till he learns to live like a white man. If he doesn't, as far as I'm concerned, he can rot in Fort Randall.
All right, Sergeant, keep them moving!
Sitting Bull's face is impassive. The great chief has suddenly realized the significance of what has happened here as Major Brotherton moves among his men and orders the arrest. He's gripped his son's shoulder hard. Grim smile has come over Sitting Bull's face, an ironical smile, almost as if he'd expected this thing to happen. The Indians are standing quietly. There's no resistance. What chance would they have if they did resist? They just look at Sitting Bull. Troopers are...
July 21st, 1881. Sitting Bull surrenders, and the Indian wars are over.
You have been listening to The Surrender of Sitting Bull, another broadcast in the series You Are There, produced and directed by Robert Louis Cheyenne. The Surrender of Sitting Bull was written by Makaja Wren and Mr. Cheyenne. Canada Lee played Sitting Bull, and the cast included Peter Hobbs, Carl Swenson, Julian Noah, Raymond Edward Johnson, and others. Chief Crazy Bull, grandson of Sitting Bull, was heard in an authentic Sioux war chant and was also consultant for the broadcast. Next week,
January 27, 1649, England. The sentencing of Charles the First. You are there.
CBS makes your 1949 Sunday evening listening a cup brimming over tonight with three fine comedy shows added to the list and Amos and Andy holding firm. Starting at 6:30 Eastern Standard Time, Spike Jonze's Spotlight Review sets the gaiety going over most of these CBS stations, to be followed immediately by The Jack Benny Show, now on CBS exclusively. Amos and Andy will be heard in their familiar spot, 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, following Jack Benny. And a little later, Life with Luigi, formerly a CBS Tuesday night refresher, starts its Sunday night run. Great drama like You Are There, great music like the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, great comedy such as those we've named, all are yours now on only CBS, Sundays in 1949. This is CBS, where Jack Benny starts tonight, the Columbia Broadcasting System.